From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the December 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Top Secret Misinformation, Part 5. This is the fifth instalment of our annual episode where we celebrate the oncoming festivities of the snowy season. Be they religious or secular, we celebrate with a surfeit not of turkey and roasties, no, but questions. Questions from our listeners, gifted to us via the medium of social media. A selection of these holiday treats, where we bust myths and reveal hidden histories, has been made by Team Podcast, who are all present and correct today. But who are Team Podcast? Along with me, Erica Munro, Head of Content at Bletchley Park, we have our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
Hello.
Our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheatham.
Good day.
And the wonderful podcast producer, Mark Cotton.
Hello.
We have six of our listeners' finest questions to share with you today. We'll do five of these as a usual Q&A, but look out for the sixth question relating to pets as we intersperse our interview with Simeon's Siginter's sidekicks and canine Codebreaker's companions. Thank you to Dr. David Kenyon for all that alliteration.
I'm going to interrupt you there.
Oh.
I think she deserves a round of applause for that intro.
Is that because I have festive flu? There's a potential that I may not remember everything I've said.
This episode is brought to you by Acme Cold Medication.
Yeah.
We'll kick off with our first question, which is, were the people at Bletchley Park able to take a break or exercise, like a run or a walk? Tom, what can you tell us?
The short answer is yes. And I think we can see in this question there's maybe an assumption that Bletchley Park was slightly unusual, but it's in many ways working here was just like working in a modern office.
Aside from the war.
Aside from the war and the nature of the work, but people came in and they did their job, but they were allowed to leave. And they were allowed breaks. But it's important to remember, you know, the people working here, especially if they're civilians, they're not forced into this work. They are allowed to go if they want. They're allowed to quit their jobs. So the management does have to pay attention to morale and staff retention and make sure that people are happy in their work. So everybody got breaks. There'd normally be, as far as I've been able to work out, that a meal break in the middle of a shift. Normal shift would be 8 hours. It might be in the middle of the night, but you would get a meal break. And there'd be a couple of tea breaks around that as well. So people would be able to get away from their desks and clear their heads, which was no doubt important. And looking at the kind of memos that were flying back and forth within the organisation, there was a little concern about the amount of time lost to these breaks sometimes. And that at one point in the war, there's a programme of placing tea urns in various offices to reduce the time people would spend schlepping over to the canteen to get their tea. I actually found...
That's very civilised. I do wish people did that today. Just a tea urn in the corner of the office. Somebody bringing it in on a trolley.
I don't know why we... Yeah, management, take note. I don't know why we don't do this now. I found reference to this in BP General Order number 94, which was issued on the 15th of June 1944, which lays out all these arrangements. It states that tea was available at a cost of a penny a cup in Hut 2, the recreation hut, the Block A pantry, Block D entrance hall, the main corridor on Block F, and also in Block G, daily between the hours of 3:30 and 4:30 p.m. And you could also get bulk supplies of tea from the canteen and milk, subject to the Ministry of Food allowance, I think a daily allowance, of a pound of tea per 280 employees and a pint of milk per 20 people.
A pint of milk for 20 people? That doesn't feel like a lot, considering...
So it's not, yeah, it's...
So no milky tea.
We would do a little bit of maths before the recording to try and work out how far this would actually stretch. And the answer is not as far as you might like. It would be slightly weak tea.
Pound of tea for 280 people, according to the marvels of the internet, represents about 225 tea bags. So for each person, you're getting slightly less than a tea bag a day.
Well, that'd be no good for me and you, Tom, because we like our tea strong, don't we?
Yes, yeah. Do it. But put it in a pot or an urn, I guess. They go a bit further, perhaps, but that's still one cup per person. That doesn't feel...
So it's slightly weak and not very milky tea we're talking about.
Delicious.
But still enough to go around just about.
Mm.
Given that in 1944 there are 7,000 or 8,000 people at Bletchley Park, if you work out how much a pound of tea for every 280 people is, it comes out at about 32 pounds of tea a day.
Can I ask what that is in kilograms?
16. For the very old listeners who remember what a tea chest looks like, Bletchley Park was getting through a chest of tea about once every 10 days.
Wow.
Which is quite a lot of tea.
Mm. Even when it's weakened.
About 40 tea chests of tea a year, which given that that tea has to come from, well, Ceylon.
Yeah. And plenty of milk as well, if it's a pint per 20 people.
I don't think that came from Ceylon. I think they had cows for that.
Probably a little more local. Still, that's quite a lot of deliveries coming in every day, just of milk alone.
Sorry, Tom, carry on.
So with all that tea to hydrate people, can you tell us about exercise? Did they get a walk or a run around at least a little bit?
Yeah, so I don't know if there's much evidence that staff were taking walks or going for runs or maybe going to the gym, as we might understand it in a modern sense, because we're a lot more sedentary now. This is a fact of life back then, is that everybody is doing a lot more walking and it's part of their daily life just because nobody has a car and they all live miles away. And a lot of staff are obviously cycling into work as well. And it's quite common here in the memoirs or reading the diaries about staff covering many dozens of miles on their bikes every day or going for very long excursions on their bikes. So I think that was where most people got their exercise. There's not a great deal of evidence of organised sport through the BP Recreational Society, but there were some activities like Scottish dancing, which we talk about a lot, were certainly good exercise. And we know about the tennis courts built at Bletchley during the war, so there was sport going on. And if you're in uniform, of course, or maybe in the Home Guard, your PT, physical training, would have been a part of your weekly routine anyway. So there was that.
Were all men at Bletchley Park in the Home Guard?
Not all of them, because a lot were exempted. I feel like we had this question last year. Never got to the bottom of it.
You can only be in the Home Guard if you are otherwise a civilian. So male civilians at Bletchley Park are in the Home Guard. All of the male service personnel are in defence companies based on their service. So there's a naval defence company, an army defence company, and an air force defence company, which make up collectively the Bletchley Park Defence Force.
Right.
But as Tom says, there were so many exemptions and people not turning up because they thought they were too important or had better things to do, that the poor captain who was in charge of it had a bit of a thankless task getting people to do anything military. But I think it was 1943 when they just went, nah, we're not doing this anymore. And rather thankfully, he gave the job up.
The point is, if staff are into sport, there's plenty of opportunity to do it. Mm. We've got a really good example, a really famous example, of course, in Alan Turing, who is a really passionate long-distance runner and would unwind by going on long runs, but he certainly wasn't the only one. If you needed time to go for a run or a walk or a cycle to recover from the long hours, staff absolutely had the opportunity to do that. Our first creature of code breaking is a young lady who turned her paw to interception at Galston Y Station. There seemed to have been an unusual amount of dogs at Y stations, especially the smaller ones, the more isolated ones, which makes sense because staff were in the same place for a while. They enjoyed good accommodation, good access to amenities, but they're also quite isolated socially and physically and doing stressful and often very dull work. So it made sense to have a canine companion around. So in the picture which accompanies this episode, you can see Corporal Dion, who served at the Y station in Galston in Norfolk with members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. There's actually several pictures of Dion in the interception room itself at one of the radio receivers trying on a pair of headphones.
She does look a bit baffled in the picture though, doesn't she? Which is understandable because she's a dog.
She's possibly not been taught Morse. Maybe she just knows German.
Surely she knows Alsatian.
Our next question is, I am interested in learning more. I love our listeners being interested in learning more. I'm interested in learning more about how employees at Bletchley Park were paid during its wartime operation. Were there any official pay scales based on education or experience? Or did salaries depend more on individual performance and success in assigned tasks? I would also like to know, were men and women paid equally for comparable positions? An excellent question, listener. And I will pass that one to David.
Yes, there were official pay scales, but of course they vary because, as we've discussed many times, people are not all employed by the same person. You have Foreign Office civilians and then people from all three services. The Foreign Office civilians in particular, we have quite good evidence of the pay and what certain individuals were paid. Of course, famously, when Alistair Denniston drew up his emergency list of wartime employees, he writes in his 1944 account of that process, specifically about pay. He said, "Through the Chief Clerk's Department, we obtained Treasury sanction for 56 seniors, men or women, with the right background and training, a salary of £600 a year. 30 girls with a graduate's knowledge of at least two of the languages required at £3 a week. Now, £3 a week is about £150 a year.
Mm.
So you can see there's quite a range from £600 a year if you're senior. But what's significant about this is also there is a significant disparity between what men get paid and what women get paid.
In that the majority of people who are in those senior positions tended to be men.
Yes. Not only that, but equivalent women in the same senior position get paid less, even if they're in the same senior position.
Mm.
So if you look at the figures we have for senior assistants, this is a Foreign Office designation. People were TSAOs, which is a temporary senior assistant officer, which is a civil service rank. At £800, at the top of the list, we have Nigel de Grey and Frank Birch. Frank Birch, head of naval section, Nigel de Grey, assistant director by the end of the war, I think. Senior people, they're getting £800. Below them are staff on £600. This includes Alan Turing, Gordon Welshman, Hugh Alexander, other famous names.
Sorts of heads of teams.
Sections, heads of teams, heads of huts. You then drop down to £480, and this is where the first women appear. The only two women on the list in the senior assistant category are paid £480. So if you consider that they're in the same nominal grade as people being paid £800, you know, there's quite a disparity.
And those women?
We know one of those women was Marjorie Dale. And we see the same if you go down the, I'm not going to rehearse all the numbers, but the next level down is junior assistant, TJAO. And here you have people like Harry Hinsley, who are on £300, but the five women on the list are only on £260. So you're seeing about a 20 to 25% discount on the wages of women versus men.
Although I'm looking at the same table as you, and I can see that in, say, the senior assistant category, there are men earning less than the women. So there's a sort of level below those women in the senior assistant, such as Stuart Milner Barry, John Herriville, in the junior assistant level. So women weren't earning the lowest of each category, but it looks as
if they're certainly not earning the highest.
Exactly. And it looks like it would be quite hard for them to get to the top of those levels. It feels like, is that as high as they could go then, sort of mid-level of each of those?
Pretty much. I mean, this isn't just a Bletchley Park thing. There was a countrywide assumption that women would earn less than men for the same work. This still hasn't been overcome 80 years later, but it was definitely an accepted fact. Well, accepted by the men, not necessarily by the women. But
yeah, we're looking at, say, senior assistant, the top end of that is £800 a year. And junior assistant, the top end of that is £300 a year. What was the average wage in the UK at that time?
The average wage at the time, again, it varies between men and women. The figures we have are for what they were sort of what would nowadays be called working people rather than sort of senior executives. But the average wage for a man was about £5 a week. And the average wage for a woman was half that, was about £2.10 a week. So if you think the women who've Denniston identified are being paid £3 a week, that's slightly better than the national average for women, but not as much as the national average for men. In fact, although he says £3 a week, it's clear that a lot of female employees weren't getting £3 a week. But the list that we have that these named individuals come from says a list of staff earning at least £3 a week. There are some women who don't even appear on the list because they don't earn £3 a week, so they don't qualify. You know, they earn too little even to get a mention, which is pretty rubbish. You also have, at the low end of the scale, earning less than £200 a year, you have the linguist grade. And the linguist grade is specifically a female role.
Only women could be linguists.
Only women could be linguists.
Right. Was a linguist a linguist?
No.
Okay. In the same way that an assistant wasn't necessarily an assistant.
Joan Clark made the joke in an interview, grade linguist, languages none, even though she actually spoke French. But her point was that linguist didn't necessarily mean linguist. It just meant female employee. And the top grade for them is £3.15, which is less than £200 a year. So a quarter of what bosses are getting. So there's a clear wage discrepancy, but most of the civilians are earning the national average wage or a little bit more.
And as you say, that pay discrepancy, the gender pay discrepancy was a socially embedded thing
absolutely,
at the time,
yes.
Awful as it was, that it was replicated at Bletchley Park. So that's the civilians. Was it any different in the armed forces?
Yes. And what's interesting here is, particularly women in the armed forces, the numbers I have are for wrens. They were paid even less than civilian women. But the difference between a civilian employee and a service employee is the service personnel get a lot of things that they don't have to pay for. So they were accommodated and they were fed to a certain extent.
Maybe not excellently fed.
In addition to their salaries. So
yeah.
They're getting more in kind, but they're being paid a lot less. So the initial pay for a wren was 14 shillings a week, which is, I hesitate to say 75p because it doesn't equate exactly, but it's £0.75.
Right.
So if you consider the other women are getting £3 and they're getting less than a pound.
Wow.
They would have had a place to sleep. They'd have got the clothing and uniform. They'd have got some food. But their discretionary income for, you know, going out for a cup of coffee or, you know, going to the cinema or whatever is pretty small. It's pocket money more than wages, really.
So a wren based at Bletchley Park or one of its outstations would be paid about the same as a wren somewhere else in the UK as well?
Yes. Those pay scales are across the board. If they were skilled, you get proficiency pay. For example, if you learnt to operate a wireless or you did Morse code or something like that, you could get proficiency pay, which would bump your pay up a little bit. Equally, if you were a commissioned officer in the Wrens, the most junior officers, the third officers, get £160 a year, which is slightly better than £3 a week.
Yeah.
But it's still only about 3/4 of what a male naval officer would get in the same equivalent rank. And that applies across all the services. As we discussed previously in an earlier podcast this year, when they get their war gratuity at the end of the year, their sort of lump sum on demobilisation, that is also only about 3/4 of what the men get.
Right.
So the wages are okay for the period, but suffer from all the biases and things that the wages of the period suffered from.
From that mixed story of pay and salary, let's move to a question we get asked all the time. Our questioner has sent in the following. There are various displays at Bletchley Park regarding dispatch riders and drivers. Why, thank you, listener, for visiting Bletchley Park. Do come again. They ask, how did this role begin and develop throughout the war years? Would these dispatch riders be used to transport time-critical and sensitive information only, or would they be used for general errands also? In addition, what challenges did they face? Multiple questions as part of this one, which I will ask Tom about. Tom, what can you tell us about dispatch riders?
Well, it's a very good question. There is a lot of focus on dispatch riders to do with Bletchley Park. But at the same time, we hear so much about them, we tend to actually emphasise other parts of the story, especially the other elements of communication. So it's good to have an opportunity to fill in some of that picture. But dispatch riders, you know, they're not invented in 1939. They go back a very, very long way. Because for hundreds of years, of course, in military operations, the quickest way to get a message across a battlefield or through enemy territory was by writing it down and giving it to somebody responsible and getting them to take it physically to its recipient, normally on horseback. And that's still true in the 20th century for a very long time because radio communications are flawed in many ways, even during World War II. The main innovation is the use of motorcycles instead of the horse, which starts off in World War I. So they're using dispatch riders right through the army during the war, and only obviously a very small proportion of them are involved with signals intelligence, but they are being used to bring intercepts famously to Bletchley Park from the Y stations, because as we say so often, messages aren't being intercepted at Bletchley Park itself.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier on in the war, dispatch riders are absolutely essential because the teleprinter links for delivering the traffic are too small scale to carry all the messages that are being intercepted. So you have a period where most messages are arriving by road and the few teleprinters that are available, they're being used to send certain real high priority messages or a certain amount of information before the main bulk of the traffic arrives, which you can use to make a head start on code breaking. So for example, when Hut 6 starts to break Army Air Force Enigma early 1940, they get the Y station at Chatham at Fort Bridgewoods to send them all the message preambles ahead of the rest of the traffic, and that lets your code breakers start to carry out analysis of those before the main text arrives. And you can save a lot of time that way. Later on in the war, most messages are arriving by teleprinter, and those are the copies that are being worked on in the first instance, but they're still bringing everything here eventually because you still need the original copies of the intercept. Just to iron out any mistakes that go on when they're teleprinted. And so you've got a hard copy of all the traffic you're working on. It's useful to have that. So they're still sending everything here physically eventually. It's not so top priority. The other thing they're bringing here is all the message logs. So your Y operator is not just writing down encrypted messages. They're writing down everything that goes on the enemy wireless networks, including all the chatter that goes on before and after the enemy actually send kind of an official encrypted message. Those logs all come to Bletchley Park as well, and they run to, you know, millions of pages. So there's no prospect of teleprinting them all to Bletchley Park, so they all have to be brought here.
It is useful, I suppose, to also to be able to say that teleprinted messages were really important. When you see dispatch riders maybe in dramatizations in the movies. You know, they're tearing across the countryside. They've got vital information that needs to be delivered immediately. But in the second half of the war, certainly, this was less so. It wasn't so time critical. And actually, it is much less, I guess, televisual to see a WAF tapping away on a teleprinter. But you're saying that even though the WAFs would have been tapping away on teleprinters, those dispatch riders were still in great number coming into Bletchley Park.
You have both. You have those hundreds of WAFs and hundreds of teleprinters across Bletchley Park. We don't actually know how many, but certainly many dozens of dispatch riders or dispatch cars as well arriving at Bletchley every day. The reason we don't have a good idea of how many there were is because none of these people are actually owned by Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park doesn't run its own dispatch riders. Whoever is intercepting the traffic on behalf of Bletchley Park, they're the ones who own the dispatch riders because they're sending stuff here. So obviously Army, Navy and Air Force personnel doing this work. We don't have a good idea of how many there were because they're not being organised from one central place. I certainly haven't found the records if they exist. The funny thing is, if you look at Bletchley Park's own weekly returns, they only own one motorcycle.
Oh, so one person sending out any messages
and hard copy. Well, one motorbike presumably used for whatever you need a motorbike for around Bletchley. But they're not doing their own dispatch rider service, that's the point. And a surprising proportion of this is probably done by car rather than by bike. We have a really nice and very detailed account of the service run between the big Army Y station at Bow Manor Hall and Bletchley Park, which comes from Joyce Robertson, who was a driver employed at Bow Manor, and this comes via the BBC People's War website. And I wondered if Erica would like to read out some of this for us.
She said, "My assignment was to make regular journeys to an unknown destination referred to as Station X, somewhere to the south. I practiced driving and was instructed to learn the roads and any landmarks along the route off by heart. It always seemed a long way, about 60 miles, and there were no signposts to go by. They'd all been removed in case the Germans invaded. I would start at Bow Manor Park and drive south through Leicester, Market Harborough and Northampton, then on to Stony Stratford and Fenny Stratford. From there, driving along some smaller roads, I would arrive at a back entrance to the Station X site, protected by armed guards and a sentry box. I had a special security pass, which authorised me to enter with instructions to go to a particular hut, not able to remember the hut number. From the entrance, I would drive my PU, personal utility vehicle, along the back of a large old house before arriving at my destination, a long wooden hut. There were other huts nearby, but I had to go only to the designated hut where I would report to the sergeant on the duty desk. The bags were signed in and inspected. Afterwards, we were sent to another hut close by where we were given a mug of tea and sometimes food. Then it was time to start the long drive back. The journey usually took about 2 hours each way, but often longer in the dark, in smog or bad weather."
Thank you, Erica. So we don't know how many quite there were, but we do know that these deliveries were organised according to quite a tight schedule. So Joyce tells us there were free services from Bow Manor Hall every day with cars on top of dispatch riders on motorcycles. And sometimes their routes are planned, so they stop off at intermediate stations on the way to pick up more material or drop it off. I've even seen some evidence that some dispatch riders even caught trains to cover certain parts of the country because that was quicker. So this is all being very carefully coordinated to make the most of the resources they have to get as much traffic to Bletchley Park as quickly as possible. And it goes on 24/7, all day and all night. It's highly responsible work, pretty dangerous, you can imagine, crossing long distances on wartime roads. Whatever the weather, knowing that you have to keep a schedule, drivers are forbidden to stop, they're forbidden to talk to strangers on the way.
In the blackout,
or take diversions,
as well, I guess.
In the blackout at night, certainly. And the other interesting fact about the dispatch riders is, of course, is that they're armed and they're trained to protect their cargo against whoever might try and take it from them on the way to their destination. Obviously, a bigger concern if you're in the theatre of operations, but the same pressure applied in this country as well, because there was always that fear of fifth columnists and enemy agents out in the countryside who might try and waylay you. So it's pretty high pressure and dangerous work.
Yeah, I've never thought of that, being sort of intercepted en route and having to fight for delivery. Wow.
There's very few people involved in singing who are actually expected to have to defend themselves or use their weapons at any point. And this is just one example.
Now, our second cryptanalyst's companion is a gibbon by the name of Tertius. Arthur Cooper, who was a codebreaker who joined GCNCS in 1938. He worked on Chinese and Japanese. We often say that our Bletchley Park codebreakers, the word eccentric has been used, but the word eccentric was used of Cooper by his friend Michael Alexander, who described him as an old-fashioned sort and eccentric. If eccentrics disobey some social conventions, though he was scrupulously courteous. Arthur Cooper went to the Far East Combined Bureau in 1939 in Hong Kong to work on Japanese traffic. While he was there, he was wandering through a market, and Chinese markets sell all sorts of things. This particular market was selling gibbons, and Cooper took pity on this one particular gibbon and bought him as a companion, took him back to FECB. In due course, in 1939, the Far East Combined Bureau was shut down in Hong Kong and moved to Singapore, where it was considered to be safer, which proved not to be the case. Arthur and his gibbon lived happily together in Singapore for several years, listening to Japanese Air Force wireless traffic and giving air raid warnings until the Japanese were about to capture Singapore and the staff of FECB were evacuated. A number of personnel were evacuated to Australia, and on 11th of February 1942, both Arthur and Tertius were able to escape by ship to Melbourne in Australia. They carried on in Melbourne, but unfortunately, Tertius's travel documents were clearly inadequate because the Australian government took a bit of a dim view of British codebreakers importing apes. And in addition, Cooper had been requested to return to GCNCS in the UK, and there was no way Tertius was going to make it to the UK. So he parted company, rather sadly, with Arthur and was adopted by Melbourne Zoo, where he lived out the rest of his life, presumably no longer having to listen to Canna Morse or indeed Japanese. The gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, terrible.
Moving our focus away from Bletchley Park, the site itself, out to outstations, we have a question, which is, was the work at outstations, like Stanmore, the same as at Bletchley Park itself, or was it specialised in some way? David, do tell us what outstations are and what they did.
Well, this is one of those questions that people, well, not get wrong, but we use the phrase Bletchley Park and its outstations quite frequently.
We do.
And quite often people think outstations is a generic term that refers to potentially the Y stations or the overseas bits of Bletchley Park, the CBME or FECB or whatever. Actually, outstation has a very specific meaning, and it means a location which has bomb machines.
And we use a capital O for outstations.
We use a capital O for outstations and a capital B for bomb and an E at the end. Bomb machines being, of course, the wardrobe-sized device designed by Alan Turing and Gordon Welshman, which was used to find the daily keys for Enigma. One of the unfortunate things, again, about the bomb is people talk about the bomb as if there was one.
Yes.
And obviously in the movie, you see Alan Turing in a shed building a machine, which he never did, but never mind.
This is the Imitation Game movie for those that haven't yet seen it.
But the thing about Enigma is the Germans are using multiple different key settings on their Enigma machines every day on different wireless networks. And so it's not a case of breaking Enigma once every day. You have to do it multiple times for all the different keys that are in use, which by the middle of the war, by D-Day, is probably 60 different keys every day. So you don't just need one bomb machine, you need lots of bomb machines. So when the first one is introduced in 1940, it's immediately clear that they don't just need one, they need as many as they can get. And so British Tabulating Machines, who are in Letchworth, basically build a bomb a week for the rest of the war.
Wow, gosh.
So by the end of the war, there are 210 bomb machines in service. They actually build 211, but the last one never leaves the factory. So where do you put them?
Yeah, I can see this would be too many for Bletchley Park itself.
Yes. The first bomb machine that's delivered in March 1940 is put in Hut 1. They then get another one, which they put in Hut 1. Then they move them to Hut 11, which is a purpose-built bomb hut, as they're called, which is designed to be, no pun intended, bomb-proof. So it's got very small windows and it's quite solidly built, concrete roof. But the other thing they do is they say, not only is there not space for all of these machines at Bletchley Park, also dispersing them to different sites. If Bletchley Park were bombed, you know, it's useful to have them distributed around so you don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, it just makes sense.
So initially they look at sites similar to Bletchley Park. They look at other country houses in the immediate local area. The first one they go for is at Adstock Manor, which is a few miles from Bletchley Park. And there they just put the bomb machines in the existing stable block of the house. And they put some wrens in there as well, who live on site and run those bombs. This is followed in 1941 by Wavendon House, again, just on the edges of Milton Keynes, as you head towards the M1, east of Bletchley Park. And then the last of the country house outstations is at Gayhurst, which is set up in 1942. This is the former home of one of the gunpowder plotters. It's a large Jacobean mansion nearby. Both Wavendon and Gayhurst get a bomb hut. They get a building like Hut 11, built in the grounds of those places where the bomb machines can be used. But the problem with all of three of these outstations, Adstock, Wavendon and Gayhurst, is that you can only fit, you know, fewer than 10 machines at each location, probably. Maybe a few more, but you can't have, you know, 20 or 30 machines there. So in 1942, they make the decision that they need large-scale purpose-built sites. And this is where first the site at Stanmore and then subsequently in 1943, the site at Eastcote are created. These are massive sites where you have buildings that look like the later blocks at Bletchley Park, Ministry of Works, spider blocks, as they're called, these big buildings with a big central corridor and then spurs coming off the sides. And by the end of the war, Stanmore has 75 machines, Eastcote has 103 machines.
Crikey.
So they're big old sites.
I should say to those who aren't familiar with British geography as well, Stanmore and Eastcote are about an hour's drive away from Bletchley, around 45 minutes from central London. So
yeah, they're both at the sort of the northern ends of tube lines.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been absorbed by Greater London nowadays. So that's what outstations are. They are locations where bomb machines are operated. And all of those machines, they were centrally controlled from Bletchley Park. And the menus, as they're called, the programs for the bomb machines to break the individual keys, would be sent out to the outstations. They would do the work, and then they would either telephone or teleprint, as we were talking about, this information would then be sent back again. What's quite interesting is, in order to manage what turns out to be 200 machines, Bletchley Park has to have a way of identifying them all. So what they do is each outstation, each of its bomb machine locations is named. But then within each outstation, the names have a theme. Adstock Manor, for example, all of the bomb bays, as they're called, are given the names of Allied aircraft.
Each bomb has a name.
Each bomb location has a name.
Right.
It's a little bit complicated because if that machine breaks down and it gets taken away and maintained and another one gets put in, the machines all have serial numbers, but the locations have names. So the machines move around and change name, but names stay in the same place. I've actually got an incredibly nerdy spreadsheet on my computer where with all of the serial numbers of the bomb machines and all the different names they had at different times.
Brilliant.
Some of them wander around quite a lot and, you know, occur in different places. So Adstock, you might have a bomb bay called Spitfire, one called Hurricane. Wavendon, they name them after Royal Navy warships. So you have Warspite and Valiant and things like this. Gayhurst, they have famous scientists, people like Ohm, Coulomb. I mean, how famous a scientist Coulomb is, I don't know. But he does have a SI unit named after him. So what's quite nice is among the famous scientists, one of the bays is named after Doc Keane.
Oh, brilliant.
Who was the engineer who designed the bomb machines for Bletchley Park.
Fantastic.
So he counts as a famous scientist. There are some bomb machines at Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. In Hut 11 and latterly in Hut 11A, there are 8 or 9 machines there. They're quite fun because a lot of those have the names of cartoon characters.
See, that surprises me. If you've got aircraft and warships and famous scientists, they're all quite worthy things to name your bomb bays after. And then Bletchley Park gets cartoon characters.
Yes.
That's brilliant. For example, what kind of cartoon characters were they? No, Mickey Mouse, I presume.
Well, no, it's more kind of Dumbo and Goofy and things like that.
And don't forget, there's one machine named after Funf from Itmar.
There is, yes.
The German spy.
Yeah, perfect.
Which is used to break the German intelligence ciphers, appropriately enough.
That is perfect.
Yes, Itmar being a radio comedy show on during the war. Hugely popular. Stanmore, each spur of the building is named after a Commonwealth country, and each of the machines within that is named after a city. So you have New Zealand Bay, we'll have Wellington and Auckland and whatever.
I mean, that makes sense. If you've got 75 machines there, you're going to have a system that allows for that
and
many options.
Eastcote, they're named after allied countries. So you have Yugoslavia and Belgium. And one of the interesting bays there is the USA Bay.
Mm.
Not only is it named after an ally, it's actually run by allies because the Americans want to be part of the bomb program so they can keep up with the technology and all that sort of thing. So they're given one bay of 10 machines
to
be run by Americans. So USA Bay is run by US personnel who all live in Ryslip Woods in a tented camp.
Male personnel?
Male personnel. Uh-huh. So you have one bay of male Americans and nine bays of wrens.
That's a recipe for success then in that case.
Yes. So as I say, talking of wrens, all of these stations, the machines are operated by female Women's Royal Naval Service personnel, so wrens. But the wrens aren't allowed to maintain the machines other than very basic maintenance. If the machine breaks, they need to get a man to fix it.
Oh my gosh.
Because it's the 1940s.
Yeah, of course.
Those men are technicians from the RAF. Or some of them are technicians and get put in the RAF because they're technicians. Mm-hmm. You get recruited because you're a telephone engineer and you get put in the RAF and you become a bomb engineer.
Well, let's say that the RAF technicians weren't trusted to operate the bombs. They were only trusted to do the repairs on
this
them.
This is true.
Let's phrase it like that.
And two wrens were put through technical training to repair bombs as an experiment, but I'm not sure whether they ever made it into service or not. It certainly doesn't seem to have been a big thing. But anyway, what that means is by the end of the war, by 1945, there are 1,610 wrens at the outstations.
Gosh.
Operating the bombs. There are 238 RAF technicians and 128 of our Americans, giving a total of 1,974 people working in the bomb outstations.
And this is, I suppose, one of the things we talk about the bomb program a lot, but there is this misunderstanding of the sheer scale of it. And it just kept growing as well throughout the war.
Yes, I mean, because wrens come and go, they leave for various reasons, there are about 2,800 wrens who are involved in the program at one stage or another.
Crikey.
So this is why when you look at our Roll of Honour and you look at our veteran interviews, we have large numbers of bomb operators just because they constituted such a large proportion of the people working for the organisation. But equally, very, very few of them are working actually at Bletchley Park. So we have veterans who we would consider a BP veteran, but they may never have been here, or they may have been here only very briefly to be sort of enrolled or attend training. Most of their career would have been spent at one of these outstations.
Mm. But still so connected to the system, as you
intimately
say.
Intimately connected, speaking every day on the telephone or whatever, but not actually here in person.
Most of the veterans I've interviewed who were bomb operators never set foot here until they came here for a reunion.
Wow.
Apart from one lady who came here to be told off once.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dressing down at Bletchley Park.
Yeah, if you got in trouble, you'd be summoned before the beak at Bletchley and then you'd go back to Eastleigh again. The other statistic or memo that I really enjoy about this is there was some concern about the establishment of Eastcote outstation. And this was expressed in the correspondence that survives in the National Archives. They were worried that Eastcote was too close to central London. And that wasn't because they were worried it would get bombed. It was because they were worried the wrens would bunk off and go clubbing.
Good for them.
Which, of course, they did.
Yes.
But being, you know, 18 to 21-year-olds, they could go clubbing all night and come back and run a bomb for 8 hours without flagging.
Oh, to be young again.
Yes, as I said, if I tried that now, it would kill me.
Our final furry friend was one who worked inside the wire at Bletchley Park itself. There don't seem to have been too many animals on site here, but there was one outstanding example in Nicky the Dachshund, who was the pet of Mr. Rees, Vincent Rees, who ran the transport section at Bletchley Park. And we know about Nicky as a result of talking a few years ago to a veteran of the administrative section, Vera Plumley. Mark, play the tape.
Could you tell me again the story from the start? If Mr. Rice was in one of the huts and you needed to get in touch with him urgently?
Well, he was next door to me.
But if he'd gone to one of the other huts?
Oh, yes. He had a little dog called Nicky. And he was a darling, a little sweetheart he was. Little dachshund. He was a kind of a minky colour. And he was lovely. And when Mr. Rice used to go, he used to go into other huts for some reason, I don't know. And Nicky would not stay with us girls. He'd go with Mr. Rice. And sometimes we wanted him urgently for something and we'd ring one of the numbers of the huts. We thought he was, and he wasn't there. And we couldn't. I said one day, well, I said, I know how to get him. And I went out into the park and I used to call Nicky, Nicky, Nicky. And then he used to bark and run to me and I used to say, go and get Daddy.
Our next question begins with a little comment about our podcast. The questioner writes, love your podcast. Always excited to see another episode in my notifications. Thank you so much. We love hearing that.
Don't worry about sending in praise and liking us and subscribing and reviewing us, because so few people do. We feel a bit unloved.
Please pop a thumbs up or a like on whichever podcast platform you listen to, or drop us an email. We love hearing from you.
Obviously, we're here to provide rigorous historical information, not to entertain people.
But we also do it for the love.
But if you happen to enjoy it, if you're that sort of masochist, then do let us know.
Please, please share. It makes our day when we get a compliment. So if you'd like to compliment us, please send us something positive. Moving on.
If you think it's rubbish.
If you think it's rubbish.
Keep it to yourself, thank you.
We're happy to hear criticism. We can take it.
Tell us what you want and we can, within reason, provide it.
You three might be happy, I'm not.
Quite seriously, though, if you did want to send us any feedback, do email enquiries@bletchleypark.org.uk. If you pop the word podcast in the subject line somewhere, it will arrive with us and we'll have a read of it. Shall we get to the question, though? The question that goes, with the arrival of the Americans to the war, other than the American bomb, what other technology did they bring to the Bletchley Park code-breaking effort? Thomas, could you tell us more?
I can. It's an excellent question. Mm-hmm. It really gets to the nub of the difference between the two allies, because even though Britain and America both had their own very substantial intelligence and code-breaking traditions, by the time World War II comes around, their approaches were very different. And you can see that they operated in silos to a certain extent. And one of the biggest differences between the two countries' approaches is in the level of mechanization, because American code-breaking is much more dependent on machinery than British code-breaking in general, just because their agencies are larger and they tend to be better resourced. So they don't have to cut corners and deal with problems maybe from an intellectual approach in the same way the British do. They're able to get large amounts of machinery, especially punch card machinery, and apply that to the problems they face. And there's a lot of talk on the American side of what they call RAM, rapid analytic machinery. And this means when American visitors come to Bletchley Park and see how it works, they find the British techniques actually quite analog and over-dependent on, you know, your brain power coming from certain individuals.
How quaint, these Britishers.
Yeah, and they're amazed by what the British are able to achieve with the kind of relatively scant resources they have. And it's likely the British learn a lot from the visitors about how to better mechanise some of their processes because they don't have that background. On the other hand, the Brits are sometimes able to teach the Americans there are smarter ways to approach some problems rather than just throwing machines at it. A great example of this is when Alan Turing goes over to America at the end of 1942. One of his tasks is to liaise with the US Navy on their program for building four rotor bomb machines. And he learns that the Americans' plan originally is to build a bomb machine for every possible rotor order of the four rotor Enigma, which is somewhat more than 300 bomb machines, which is an unthought of number on the British side because they have like 40 bomb machines at this point and they can't imagine having 300. And then Turing points out that because you have techniques like Bamburismus, which you can reduce the number of possible rotor orders you have to test, you don't actually need 300 bomb machines. And if you make the rotors swappable, then you can apply more than one bomb machine to test, you know, the smaller number of rotor orders that you've been able to narrow it down to. And that's a much more efficient way of using your machinery. And that's what the Americans do. And that's one of the reasons why their bomb program is so successful. So this exchange of knowledge and expertise goes both ways. And to answer the question more directly, Americans absolutely make a substantial contribution to operations at Bletchley Park other than the bomb machine. A really good example is a machine which is quite close to my heart, known as Dragon.
First of all, why is it quite close to your heart?
Just because I think it's cool.
Tell us why you think it's cool.
This is one of the kind of auxiliary machines, I suppose, used to break fish traffic, Lorenz traffic, alongside the famous Robinson and Colossus machines that do most of the key finding. You have a machine called Dragon, which is designed by and built in the first instance by the Signal Security Agency in Arlington Hall, so the US Army codebreakers. They do this in August 1944, it's finished, and they ship it over to Bletchley Park, and it arrives in October 1944, and they place it in a large room in Block F where they've removed several of the partitions between the offices to make space for it. And this looks like a lot of your codebreaking machines. It's a lot of telephone exchange racks with relays on them. And what the Dragon does, hence the name, is to drag a crib through a Lorenz message to try and find a place where the crib fits. Now, I'm not going to go too much into Lorenz breaking right now because we don't want to be here all day. If you want to find out more, go back to listen to Colossus in Context. That's a two-part episode we did a couple of years ago, episode 159 and 160. But if you have a message which has been broken on Colossus to the point where you understand the chi wheel settings of the message, if you have two sets of wheels on a Lorenz machine, chi wheels and psi wheels, if you set the chi wheels, you need to find the psi wheel setting. This is what Dragon can do for you. You have the psi wheel patterns already. You program the Dragon with those psi wheel patterns, which you've previously discovered, and your crib, and it effectively drags your message in front of this crib, and it's looking for an output which looks like plain language. And when it finds that, the machine stops, and hopefully you've set the side wheels on your message.
I love that name. Like a bit like the, who knows if the bomb is, the bomber rather, the Polish bomber is called bomber for the noise it made. But I think people have sometimes, I think, said that dragon made a loud noise, but it's from all that dragon it does.
I think it might be a bit of both.
I like that.
It might be one of those code names which makes sense in more than one way. So the Dragon's a really useful machine. It does a job that you can do on Colossus, but it does it a lot more quickly. So it frees up Colossus to work on starting to break into new messages. And Dragon can just do some of the cleaning up afterwards. So when Dragon arrives and they set it up, it comes with its own overseer, who is a Sergeant Tom Collins from the US Army. He arrives with all these crates. We have quite a good account of this from Jill Hayward, who worked at Dollis Hill. And the first funny thing is that when they unload the machine, the Brits are more interested in the crates than they are in the machine itself, because they haven't seen good quality timber for about 4 years.
Oh,
and the Americans think, oh, it's just a box, we'll throw it away. And by, apparently the crates are very quickly dismantled and all the timber disappears within a few hours of the machine arriving.
That's so like somebody getting a Christmas present and playing with the wrapping paper, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe a pet cat more interested in the box that its toy comes in than the toy itself. The Brits get round to looking at the machine and they find that they're not allowed anywhere near it because Sergeant Collins is protecting it with his life and with his service pistol. He's always armed and he won't let any of the Brits actually go anywhere near his machine. And with a certain amount of inevitability, Sergeant Collins is very quickly nicknamed Sam Scram, who is the American gangster character from ITMA. So you get to see the cultural influence of ITMA on British SIGINT. And we have this account from Jill Hayward about the moment they turn the machine on. He said, Sam threw the main switch, causing the most deafening clatter and grinding noise we had ever heard coming from an assembly of relays. It sounded like a monster munching its way through sheets of tin plate. The load on the power supply was so great that the room lights dimmed as several hundred relays pulled in at once and then brightened again on their release. Sam seemed to think this was normal.
As everything flickers and...
This machine basically pretty much single-handedly knocks out the Bletchley Park
power supply. It's alive!
Kind of picture this as well, like everything flickering and people going, is it going to blow the whole thing?
So then Sam oversees his machine for a few weeks, trying to break traffic. It clatters away and eventually, with apparently a certain amount of inevitability, it breaks down. And then what happens is quite interesting. As Jill Hayward tells a story, his colleague Sidney Broadhurst from Dollis Hill, who's another member of this operation that led to Colossus, he sidles up to Dragon, the broken down Dragon, and says, we can build something like this. And he goes away, and apparently about 3 weeks later, he'd made a far superior version of Dragon. So you have Dragon 2 that comes along, the British version. Actually, the fact is this took about 11 weeks. And we know there was some involvement from a codebreaker called Angus McIntosh at GCNCS, who was in the military section. And we have photographs of him in our collection with the machine. So it seems like this might be another example of Dollis Hill kind of blowing its own trumpet a little bit. But there's a British version of the machine that comes along and works quite effectively until the end of the war. And the story is that when it's been in operation for a while, Sam Scram comes back to have a look at it and asks the Brits when they're going to turn it on. And they say, it is on. Because the British machine is so well designed, it doesn't even make any noise.
None of the lights are flickering. There's no peril involved.
It just glides along, breaking traffic, smooth as anything. So obviously a little bit of transatlantic rivalry in that story, but the two sides come together very effectively to build this Dragon machine. And that's not the only example. Another really important part of the story is that at the Y stations, intercepting all the traffic, obviously essential work, without which Bletchley Park can't do anything, all of their radio receivers and frequency meters and all the other radio kit is American, because the companies that make the best equipment, they are building it for the large American amateur radio market. And because amateur radio operators need very sensitive receivers, those are the best designed for your Y service work. So thousands of receivers are provided to the Y services under Lend-Lease by the Americans. And lots of technical components are shipped across, like uniselectors and things that go into all sorts of machinery. Another example is down in Block C at Bletchley Park, they get all their tabulators on special order from the USA. And as the story goes, when they opened the crates in Block C, they found there were gifts of food, which had been included in these packages from the Americans, and gave the staff in Block C their first introduction to Spam.
Spam, salty goodness. Very apt for our Christmas episode as well, the arrival of very welcome gift.
I think someone needs to mention the fact that our sergeant is also named after a cocktail.
Tom Collins.
Yes.
I like Sam Scram.
What's in a Tom Collins?
Rum.
There you go. Spam and rum. Christmas has never been better.
That brings us to the end of our listeners' questions. But before we go, I think, Mark, you had something to say, didn't you?
Yes, I want to say a big thank you, not just to our listeners, but also to the wider podcast team. That's Vicky, our occasional host, and our wonderful, what should we call them, voice actors. That's Dr. Ben Thompson, Owen Mugan, and Sarah Langston.
Thanks also to our special guests that we've had throughout the year, and the veterans whose voices we've been hearing. And without further ado, I think it's worth us wishing our listeners a very
Merry Christmas!
That's the hardest 2 hours I've ever heard.
Pint?
Hell yeah. You buying?
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.